My name is Marita Harris, and I plan to share a few vignettes of my life in regard to race relations. And I want to share, want you to share also. And we're to stop about 7:15, so we don't have any time to waste. But what I would like to do is to let you either ask questions or share something of your own. And I might say that my own thinking about race relations is it's not just the black question or minority question. It's everybody's business. It's everybody's concern. And the experiences that I have had tell me more than anything else that white people, although they're the majority, they're very much involved, and they have a great responsibility, too, to make our race relations better. And I have two or three things I'm going to share about what happened to me during my lifetime, and then we'll let you ask questions or share. When I was about 12 years old, I was in South Georgia, and this is my earliest recollection about race relations, when I was very much aware of the difference between whites and blacks. I lived in the country, and we walked to school about a mile, and a daily situation was that the white kid would chase the black kids home. And we were very much afraid. And one day I turned around and I got angry and I started chasing them. So they ran just as we had been running. Well, every time I think about that, I don't think about it a great deal, but through my life I have thought about that, and it tells me that there's something I can do to change situations. Don't just take it lying down and do nothing. Sometimes we have to think of what we need to do, but it tells me that I have a responsibility to do something. I don't just sit and wait for you to do it all. I have something to do also. At about age 25, I was in Virginia, and I had a white teacher who was, we had a mixed staff there, and of course this was long before school integration, and especially in the South, the schools were definitely segregated. But in Virginia, we had a mixed staff. And I had a white teacher who really, I think, got me on the road to being healed, because I think I definitely needed healing so far as race relations were concerned. And this teacher, bless her heart, she would not let me get away with anything. She held me to what was right. But somehow, and I don't remember all the details of what made me understand this, somehow I knew that she loved me, that she respected me, that I was not a black student to her, I was a student. It didn't matter about the color. And she really is the one that got me started towards healing. And I consider myself now colorblind. And of course, that isn't completely true, but in a way it is. I don't think about color when I look at people. I don't think about whether they're black or white unless something special happens that calls it to my attention. Otherwise, it's a matter of being colorblind, and I like that. And she's the one that got me started on it. And I consider it healing, you know, when we are in too bad a situation, one way or the other, it doesn't matter. It's an illness, and we do need healing. So I feel that it started me on the road to being healed. And I think that now, just like my health, I don't consider myself completely healed, because as I said, if certain things come up, it might bring it back to my mind, or I might react a certain way that I don't normally react to. But I think that healing is very important, and we are never healed in our physical body. I mean, we're healed, but we might get sick again. You may have a headache today, and you may not have one again for another year. But something physical might happen to you and you need healing again. So I feel that so far as race is concerned and emotional health and race relations, I think that I will continue to need healing at some point or other, even though the situation is so different and I don't think about it much. I think that I must be open to recognizing that something needs to be healed. They introduced me by saying I was the first black teacher in the Seattle school system, and I was. I was one of three that were hired in 1947. Well, that's not what I did, and what happened to me is not all that important. The thing that is important is that here it is, 1947, and there are no black teachers in the city system, and Seattle is a pretty good-sized place. There was one black teacher in the Tacoma system, but there was none in the Seattle system. And I won't take time to give you all the blow-by-blow description of how I happened to be in Seattle and had not planned to stay there, but did finally make it my home, and I'm still there. And that was 1947 when I went there. But the leader of the Urban League asked me about teaching, and I said, no, I got out of the teaching field because it didn't pay enough. And I found that being a dietitian paid more money. So he said, well, I'm sorry to hear that because we've been working, trying to get a black teacher in the system for years, and we think the time is right. So I said, well, when you put it that way, I'll consider it. Well, I had been a real fighter in race relations, you know, from the time I was a teenager. And here I was quite an adult and had been for some time and still was a fighter in race relations. And so I felt that this was something I could help with. So that's how it happened that I decided to stay and became one of the first black teachers there. Now I want to tell you about two or three other incidents, because these are the incidents that stand out in my thinking. While I was in Seattle, the early part of the time when I was there, and I don't recall whether it was before I did this year of teaching or whether it was after, but anyhow, there was an advertisement for a dietitian at a certain club there. It was a very fashionable club. And I went to answer this ad because I had been working in the field of dietetics for, oh, I guess about 6 years by then. And when I went to talk to the woman who was going to interview the applicant, she looked me straight in the eye and said, but we want a dietitian, not a cook. And so I've thought about that over the years. You know, I've never really forgotten that because that was very important. And I told her, but I am a dietitian. And I was certified then by the American Dietetics Association. And somebody asked me sometimes when I tell this story, they will say, well, what did she say then? I said, well, I don't know. I haven't the slightest idea what she said then. That's not the part of the story anyway. So anyway, there are two other incidents that I want to tell you about because I think they're important. And one of the things that I haven't said is that I'm a great believer in prayer. And a lot of things that have happened to me, I have prayed about them. And sometimes after they have happened, I have prayed about them. And I just feel that God leads me, directs my path, and also helps me to forgive those people that I find hard to forgive. And during my lifetime, things have happened to me that I've found it very hard to forgive people. But I know that that we have to forgive because that's what Christ tells us, and that's what he wants us to do, and I know that's what he wants me to do. He wants me to forgive. And when I find trouble doing that, just makes me pray harder, because the Bible tells us, you know, that if we don't forgive, then God can't forgive us. So I want to tell you two more of these incidences. One is about my church, which is a Church of the Epiphany in Seattle. I'm an Episcopalian. And when my little segregated church there closed down, we were being sent to the other churches, presumably the ones that were close to us. And I discovered that we were being sent to about three different churches in the community. And I live in the central part of Seattle. But we were not being sent to Epiphany, which is in Madrona, and it's really right on the edge of the central area too. In fact, it's closer to me than some of those other churches that I was being sent to. And we had a young white priest, and I asked him, why aren't we being sent to Epiphany? Why is it not suggested that we go to Epiphany? And he says, that's because they don't want you. Now, that was not very smart, probably, but he was young. He was young, and he just told it like it was, and I'm glad he did, because... to follow up after that, that I said to him when he told me that, I said, well, that's where I need to go. As I told you, I was a fighter during my young years. I said, well, that's where I need to go. And so I immediately went. And someone was asking me recently if I was the only black person at this rather wealthy white church. And I said, oh, no, there are a few black people there. And there's still not a lot of them, but there's still, and at that time, I was just estimating, trying to recall the number of people I remember seeing, black people that went to that church. And I was guessing maybe about six, but I'm not sure how many. But it was a very small number. And you see, in the black church, I think historically it has been a social thing also. It's not just religion. It's social, and people talk to each other and they visit each other, and you know each other. And so when it came time for me to transfer to that church, in fact, I didn't even have to think about it too much. I knew that my social life was of such that I didn't need to worry about it. I didn't have to depend on the church for my social life. Well, you see, at the little church where I was, we invited each other into our homes, and, you know, it was like a small family. Well, when you get the races mixed up and the social strata mixed up, they don't always want to do that. And so some of the black people didn't want to move. And I was quite sure that part of it was because they felt uncomfortable. And I said to myself, well, I have enough security so that I can live without being socially involved with those people. And so that was one of the reasons that it didn't take any struggle or any long thinking for me to, it was almost immediate response. And one of the things I say about praying is that I try to surrender my life to God on a daily basis. And I try to do that in the morning when I have my prayers and meditation. And I don't constantly do it. It has to be done, as far as I'm concerned. It has to be done. It has to be repeated. But I don't just go repeating it all day, you know. I will do it in the morning. And then maybe other times in the day, and maybe not verbally, maybe I'm not conscious of it, but my main point is I surrender to God and tell him to control my life, to direct my life and show me what he wants me to do and to give me the strength to do it. So sometimes there are questions that I will ask that I need to pray longer over, and I will do so. But sometimes I don't need to ask, you know, I'm already set up so that I know what the immediate response is, and that was one of them. I knew that I needed to go and to expose myself. And I hadn't, I don't often share this with people about being ready to expose yourself, because a lot of black people aren't ready to be hurt and to expose themselves to discrimination and prejudice. And one of the things I have learned in my life, that we have to be willing to do that, that you don't get to know black people unless some black people expose themselves to you and let you know when you hurt them, what they don't like, and what they do like. And I think that that's one of the ways we help to change things, is to expose ourselves and be available and let you know what hurts us and what doesn't. In fact, some of my experiences have involved friends that were so close that I could tell them. You know, I could be very explicit with them and say, well, now, and they could with me too, because sometimes I get off the beam. I think something is racial prejudice and it isn't. And when I've had white friends that I could talk to and they could talk to me, and we could say, well, now this situation, I would tell, I had a desk partner like that at work, and I would tell her this situation happened, and I think it was discrimination. It was prejudice. That person was prejudiced. And she would examine it, and she might tell me, no, I don't believe that. Same thing would have happened if they had been white. If you had been white, the same thing would have happened. And so I've always appreciated that kind of friendship where you can really talk to each other as to what you think, even you might be disagreeing. And so I went to Epiphany, and I was there about 20 years before I really felt at home. And I have been there, I guess, about 30 years now or more, and I feel very much at home. The rector that we have now is very fond of me. In fact, we go around doorbelling. I call it doorbelling because he's new, and he wanted to know what people are close to the church. And so he asked me to go with him up and down the streets, and we knock on doors and tell people about Epiphany, where it's located. And he's the new rector. And so one of our church members, and it may have been more than one, but one that told me about it, said, well, she says, I see you walking up and down the streets, and you're called the odd couple. Well, that's pretty good, because here he's white and he's in his 40s. I don't remember exactly how old he is, but he's in his early 40s. And here I am, black and 78, and there we go up and down the streets. But I've enjoyed that very much. Now there's one more I need to tell you about, and then I'm going to let you talk or ask questions. I was at Koinonia, and I'm sure some of you are familiar with Koinonia. Somebody told me there was someone here from Koinonia. And I was a volunteer at Koinonia for 2 terms, which was 6 months. And during the time I was there, this was in Georgia, and I told you I grew up in Georgia, and although I hadn't lived there for many years, here I was back in Georgia, and something was going on about the Ku Klux Klan. And I think one of the things that was happening, they were supposed to protest some march, I think, about Martin Luther King or something. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it didn't make much sense. And I had always been prejudiced against the Ku Klux Klan because of all the different things they did. And one of the things that I did while I was at Koinonia was to pray harder and to meditate and to try to improve my religious life. You know, and I'm sure that's the type of thing that goes on around here. You know, you have time to meditate and think, and you try to improve yourself. And so that's what was going on at Koinonia, and I would walk across the soybean fields early in the morning. I went to a silent meditation, and I was wrestling after I realized that I was still feeling this negativism about the Ku Klux Klan, the KKK. And I said, well, one of the things that I had been struggling with, you know, is that God said you're not supposed to hate. You're supposed to love. And when I started wrestling with the KKK, I knew that that regulation and rule applied to them just like it did to anything else. It didn't say you're supposed to love all those people who are nice to you and who do the right thing, but you're supposed to love and not hate. So I had to wrestle with that one. But the thing I want to tell you that was a surprise to me, pretty soon I was back in Seattle, and here was the KKK on the TV again. And I had prayed in the meantime, but the thing that surprised me was I didn't seem to hate them anymore. I didn't feel, you know, I didn't feel like I had felt over the years about them. And I know that, you know, only God could take care of that. Only Jesus could change my heart and help me to realize it's all right for you to hate the things that the KKKs do, but you can't hate the individuals. And so I was surprised at that, because even though I was praying about it, I really didn't expect anything like that to happen. I don't think I expected anything to happen. But here it happens, and I'm just real pleased that I can count on God, I can count on Jesus Christ, that if I'm serious and if I do my part, He's going to do His part. Amen. So now I'm going to give you a chance to talk or ask questions or whatever.
During those 20 years that it took you to get comfortable, that epiphany, did you ever feel like you were unwanted because it took you so long?
No, I never felt unwanted. The question was, I don't know whether all of you heard it, the question was, during the time at Epiphany, before I felt really that I was at home, this is my church, did I feel
unwanted?
No, actually, I never did feel unwanted, because the priest who was there, the rector, welcomed me. And there is one little incident I want to tell you that I think you'd be interested in. He was well known. This Epiphany has a lot of well-to-do people in it, and the rector and most of the people who, well, I don't know what percentage, but the people that I would be close enough to hear them greet each other. It was John and Jane and, you know, first name basis. And I was Mrs. Harris. Now, you know, one of the big things that we used to have about the black situation was white people did not want to call black people Mr. or Mrs. And so we fought for that, you know. We had a right to be called. I had a right to be called Mrs. Harris. Well, we had kind of settled that, you know, and I was used to that. And so he called me Mrs. Harris. But I don't know how long I had been there. And one morning, coming out, you know, at most churches, and especially ours, the priest stands right on outside the door unless the weather's bad, and they might stand right on the inside. But as you go out, you're greeted. And it's not the only one, but that's the system. And one day I was coming out of the church, and he greeted me as Marita. And I was so shocked and so pleased and so surprised. I said, I wondered when I was going to become a member of this family. And of course, that was very early, because there was another situation which I don't know, I felt pretty badly about it, but it was one of those early ones that made me question whether or not I was welcome. It was one of the things that delayed my feeling welcome, I guess. The Episcopal Church changed its liturgy, changed the prayer book in 1979. And, I had been there. I went there in 58. So I'd been there for quite a little while. But 9 years before it got changed, we were always trying things out, you know. We tried out about 3 different prayer books. We had the green book and the zebra book, and I don't remember what else. But anyway, we would try them out for 3 years. And then we had the exchange of the peace. Well, I find that most churches now exchange the peace, but that was our beginning of the change of the peace. And now most Episcopal churches will do it. They'll either shake hands or they'll embrace each other. And during this beginning, one of these trial liturgies, I walked across the aisle to shake hands with a woman. And she was white, of course. And I felt, now I know this was my imagination, but I felt that she straightened up and in her full height stood as tall as she could and looked down her nose at me. Now I can't remember anything else because I guess my mind went blank at that point. I don't remember whether she really shook my hand or whether she didn't. I don't know what happened. But anyhow, it made me feel very badly. And of course, it took me a long time to get over that. I finally did get over it, but it took me a long time. Now, something else from some of you.
I'm wondering why they segregated your church in the first place.
It was requested by some of our black people. You know, one of the things that's said about black people, they like segregation. If you haven't heard that, you haven't been around much. They like to be together. They don't say they like to be segregated. They'll say, well, they like to be together. And when I used to hear that, and when I was in the field of race relations, I would say, well, why do you suppose they like to be together? That's because they know each other, and they know that you're not going to hurt them. And if you get to know a white person, you know, I learned that. I don't know whether I knew that when this person was talking or not. But when I get to know a white person, I like to be with them too. It's not a matter of color. It's a matter of getting to know them. But this church, and of course this church had been started, I went there in 47, and I don't remember how old it was, but it was already, it had been established quite a long time. And I think it was 26, I'm not sure, but I think that's when it started, in 1926. Well, of course, race discrimination was, you know, it hadn't moved as far as it has now. And so, of course, the older people were quite anxious to be together and be alone and, you know, to feel wanted and able to take positions. And so that's why, and the bishop closed it down almost for the same reason. We had a different bishop at that time. He didn't like a segregated church in the first place, but he let it go on because people wanted it. But then when it got where it wasn't thriving, and all the new black people that came to town went somewhere else, he closed it down. Anybody else with a question or comment? Okay.
Rita, how did the children react to you as their first black teacher in very early years?
Well, I didn't have little children. This was at Edison Technical School. I had taught before, but I had taught black children in Georgia. So in Seattle, I had teenagers and adults, and I did have some white and some black, so I didn't have little children. But, you know, children, you'd be surprised, what they do represents what goes on at home, and they aren't nearly as likely to be concerned about what color you are, you know, and certainly not in the discriminatory attitude. Because in my earlier years when I was working in race relations, sometimes I would be going down the streets, you know, on a little child about 4 or 5, something like that, but very small, would be quite interested. This would be in areas where you don't see black people, would be very interested. And I've had them ask me, "Are you a nigger?" And I would say, "No, I'm a Negro." And of course, the black people have, you know, from time to time have wanted to be called this or that or the other. So there was a time we wanted to be called Negro, then we wanted to be called black, and I understand now we're called African Americans. And I guess it doesn't make too much difference. But children are not, you know, I don't think they are prejudiced. they react according to what goes on around them. They're curious, and I have been close to white children where they would, you know, they'd see my black skin, they would want to touch it. They want to see what it's like. What does it feel like? You know, is it just like mine? So they're curious, yes.
I can question that. My parents' best friends as I was growing up were Chinese. And to this day, she reminds me, the Chinese lady reminds me, she used to bribe me with nickels to get me to come near her. And obviously, as I say, they were my parents' best friends. I had no reason to fear her.
Yeah.
So I think maybe there is a little bit of reticence, at least, that's built into us.
New things. Things that we don't understand and different things. But my experience has been that I can tell they're close to what the parents think, you know, by what the child says. Because you don't always have to tell them. They pick it up. They know how you feel about things. Anybody else? Okay.
Could you speak a little bit, or you could feel free to comment on the school system as we have it today, because at least for me, we still have some very strong tensions within the schools between not only young people, but even in staffs. What is your reaction to this?
I mean, well,
really just not made any progress at all? Or what's your
I think we've made progress, and I don't think I'm really qualified to say much about it since I'm not involved in it. I don't work in it, and I don't have children in it, but I do have my opinions from time to time when I stop to think about it. And I think that some of the things that have happened are not the best things. And I'm always glad to see people trying to work it out. But I suppose you're talking about busing. That's the thing I hear most about, is about busing. And of course, black and white people don't like busing. And I don't know, I think it's too bad that we have to resort to things like that to bring about better race relations. But it hasn't worked in a lot of instances and situations. It hasn't worked. And I really feel that if we just had the right attitude, you know, we just loved one another, that it would work itself out. But we're fighting each other all the time.
I guess I had a reference. I come from Tacoma. We've had some severe tensions at times between fighting in the schools, between racial groups on the way home. Maybe that reflects us as parents. Whatever it is, it certainly doesn't seem at times that we've come a long way. I mean, it seems like we're back.
I know what you mean. It seems like we're back where we were.
Where we were.
Yeah.
I mean, you think, you know, we're almost in 90. We should be getting past some of this somewhere.
Well, I think that's the human condition.
Isn't some of that gangs related to drugs, quite apart from race, though?
Yeah.
That's
quite possible because...
Western Washington lately with the gangs from California.
It's very... hard for me to understand the drug scene and all the terrible things that go on.
Right? Of course, as far as the gangs and race, I mean, racism is the heart of it, of gangs. We don't have gangs here, and that's something totally different, a different problem. It's closely related. Those gangs are usually made up of one of kind of a group of people against another race of people. So it's definitely racism coming up, cropping up again with a new face, expressing itself in a new way in the children.
Well, around here, the ones that I hear about, I don't know, I had the impression that they were all black. I don't know. There's been two names that I hear about from time to time that they're fighting each other, these gangs. And I don't know whether it's has to do with race.
Well, they have two major gangs that have come from California, but the residual effect has been that now we get into ethnic gangs, and we have gangs of different ethnicities, and it's just become more and more tangled. not ironically, I think it is more people of color, mainly men, although there are female gangs, do not be misled. More people of color are in gangs than not, especially the youth.
Anybody else?
I'm just a little curious about, I'm a teacher, and I try to imagine myself not doing it sometimes, and I can't. I wonder if you ever felt at any point going back into it, and have you, in any capacity besides in the classroom, used that teacher part of yourself, and how?
I think I use, I consider myself a good teacher. Mm-hmm. You know, I can tell people how to do things. I can give good examples. And I think that I have the skill of a teacher, even though that was not the profession I followed throughout life. I was a social worker. And, of course, I had to learn how to work with people, mm-hmm. people with children, and how to solve problems, how to recommend, and how to understand different situations. So I think we use whatever skill we have, because I have some friends who are, you know, who have been teachers all their lives, and I don't think they're very good teachers, because they don't really know how to teach people things and how to be patient with them. So I do use the skills that I have, and sometimes, though, I think that I have attributed mine to being a Christian, too.
Yeah.
You know, that, but I don't know whether that's a good answer or not.
It is. Because I've already concluded, you're doing it now.
Yes.
I'm just curious as to whether you want to go back into the classroom, because I know you're teaching. Yeah.
Well, I have always helped people, right. You know, and... So I guess that one doesn't have to be in a classroom.
True.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we do have about 10 more minutes. Yes.
I don't blame you for not having an easy time with the Klan. I have a very difficult time with them, and the Aryan Nations, and all of them.
Yeah.
I guess I really never prayed about it, because
mm-hmm.
I just have just gone on not doing anything about them, but just detesting them with all my soul.
Yeah, yeah.
And just wishing they would go away or something.
I can understand what you mean, because... mentioning the Aryan Nation and some of these, you know, way out groups that do things. I think I don't know whether there are other Christians like me. Sometimes you forget to pray about these things. You know, you just forget about it. And, well, I tell you, it occurs to me now that one of the names on my prayer list, I have a long prayer list that it's been collected over a period of time, and sometimes I drop them off, and sometimes I add more for different reasons. And somebody suggested that I pray for Gorbachev. And this was long before all the changes went on. I think it was, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago. I really don't remember when it happened. But somebody suggested, why don't you pray for him? And I said, yeah, that's a good idea. And so I put his name down on my prayer list. And so each morning when I read off my names of people I'm praying for, it was his name. And then when all the changes started taking place in Russia, so I really am a firm believer in prayer, and sometimes we forget to pray about things. I don't know, we think it's so far out, or, you know, it's so preposterous. And I think sometimes we think God can't handle it either, you know. So the situation is so bad that God can't do anything about it. But we ought to try it sometimes.
No, I want to say just three things I'm thinking as you're talking. One is, I want to thank you for really saying what you just said about your faith and your approach. At my age, I'm learning to do that and to put my life in God's hand. And that is real inspiration for me. Mm-hmm. Two, you obviously have been called to intercessory prayer. So, three, please put me at the top of your I want you to move God. Two names underneath.
I don't promise people lightly that I pray for them. When you ask me to pray for you, I ask you, what do you want me to pray about? And we talk about it. And then I decide if I'm going to do it. In other words, I don't lightly. Oh, okay. There was a time in life, and somebody would say, well, pray for me. And, you know, I wouldn't answer. I would say, okay, or something like that. But anyway, that would be the end of it, because I wouldn't think of it anymore. So now, when somebody asks me to pray for them, I usually ask them, what do you want me to pray about?
Well, you'll see me again before
you. I don't promise lightly. I need to know what I'm praying about and write it down. I'm very forgetful now, and so I have to write. I put your name down there. And I sometimes have other people to ask me to pray about somebody else. In other words, you'd ask me to pray for a friend of yours or a relative or whatever, and I have to put something down there to help me remember who the person is. Who is Jane Doe? You know, what are we praying about? And so if you gave me the name, I would say friend of Jackie's or whatever, you know. So God does answer prayer. He doesn't always answer the way you expect and when you expect. But he answers, and so I'm very thankful for that.
Can you talk a little bit about your work with the Quakers and
All right, the American Friends Service Committee is considered the right arm of the Quakers, and one of the things that happened to me when I went to Seattle was I lived in a Quaker hostel. I think the reason they invited me to live in their hostel was because they were changing from an undergraduate group to a graduate group. And this Friends Center had six women living there. So when the undergraduates left and the graduates came, I was in the graduate school. And so they invited me to live in their center, which was right across the street from the university. And I didn't know anything about the Quakers when I went there. And it has been a very exciting experience for me because I stayed there until I got married. I got married out of their facility and I was there 3 years. And then in the meantime, while I was there and later on, I became a volunteer for the American Friends Service Committee. And so I guess I chaired most all of the usual committees that they had. I started off being the chairman for the college committee, and I was always surprised. It was because the person because I was the one expecting this teacher. He taught at the university, and I expected he would be the next college committee chairman. And when I mentioned that, he says, oh no, he says, you're going to be the next committee chairman. And I was not a college teacher, so it never occurred to me that I could be chairman of that committee. Well, that was the beginning. So I was chairman of the college committee, in due time the Indian committee, the high school committee, and it seems to me there was one other. But anyway, I went to Hiroshima with Floyd Smoe, who's a Quaker, and he had his own group, and still does. He's working on a peace park now that's right beside it. Well, the Quaker Center moved since then because the university took over the property. So anyway, I still feel close to them, and Floyd Smoe has celebrated his 95th birthday last month, in July. And I went with him to Hiroshima in 1950, and we built houses. And that was a very exciting experience for me, because I liked the Quakers. And he was trying, the reason for this was an interracial team. So he had, of course we had Japanese because we were in Japan. And there was quite a number of Japanese Quakers available. So Floyd is white, he had a Chinese fella, he had me, black, and then it was, so that was four. And we built houses. Somebody said, well, the Japanese could build houses better than you. I said, sure. In fact, I heard Floyd say this, and I agreed with him, that the main purpose was not to build houses. That was just the vehicle by which we went over to say, I'm sorry that the bomb was dropped on you. And of course, Quakers don't believe in war. And they have varying degrees about their belief, but they don't believe in war. And so he went over so to help pick up the pieces and help to build friendships. That's what he was trying to do, build friendships. And we built friendships through building houses, which turned out to be pretty nice. Any other part of that you want me to mention?
Maybe just if you could briefly talk about your experience with race relations and trying to develop that, going to like restaurants and...
Oh yes, that was... and we're going to have to stop pretty soon. There was a group when I went to Seattle, two groups that worked on racial improvements. And one was Christian Friends for Racial Equality, and the other one was New Year's Callers. They were in their heyday at that time, very much needed. The Christian Friends for Racial Equality was trying to get black people accepted into the churches, and that is not just not to go and be a member, but just to go and visit and worship, you know, and be welcomed. And the other thing was to get restaurants who would not serve black people to serve them. This was their main function. And when I landed in Seattle, one of my friends took me to Frederick and Nelson's because they had what at that time was called the fifth floor dining room. And they didn't serve black people. And they had promised the Christian Friends for Racial Equality that they would stop discriminating like that. They would serve black people. So this friend of mine said, I want to take you to Frederick and Nelson's and see if they're doing what they said they would do. And they served it without any trouble.
What year?
Let's see, 47. 47. It may have been 48 by then, but I went there in 47. And this was before 1950. And it was either 47 or 48. And there were several restaurants in Seattle that wouldn't serve black people. I mean, some nice restaurants. There was another one, and I can't remember what it was. But the Christian Friends was working with them, too, and I was taken. I was part of the guinea pig. But we went with two whites and two blacks. And this is why I said that white people can do an awful lot to help wipe out discrimination. It's not just one race. It's, you know, it's all of us together. And we went four, and two whites and two blacks. And so we planned that the whites would go in and reserve the table for four people, and then we would join them. So that's what we did. And we came in about 15 minutes after they'd been there, and we asked for this lady by name. And the hostess said, why, there's nobody here by that name. We don't have anybody. And so my black partner said, but I thought I saw her car out there. Well, of course, we knew they were in there because we all came together. And so anyhow, the hostess knew immediately what was going on. She knew that this was a trap. And so she went back in to these two women that were in there. And I don't know whether to say they argued. They talked for 45 minutes. But they did let us come in. They let us come in. And it's time for me to stop, isn't it, Jackie?
I understand that there's some Seattle golf clubs that don't take black members, according to this morning's paper.
Oh.
Don't take what?
Black members. there's a great big whole story on the whole golf tournaments and discrimination. I wanted to raise a question about not being colorblind.
Okay.
I am not colorblind. I don't consider myself colorblind. I consider myself a color advocate. Mm-hmm. When we have communion, I remember once we had communion, we didn't have any black. We have an integrated church. We didn't have any black members serving communion. Well, we have never had that situation since that time because we raised Cain because people weren't color conscious. Mm-hmm. Enough to know that
they didn't have any.
Well, yeah, that they simply weren't taking reality into account. And I do think that
you've got a good point there.
It's like Holden. Holden doesn't have. It now has the pastor. Mm-hmm. But how can Holden ever expect to have the mountaintop experience regularly if it doesn't get some people in positions of responsibility on the staff? And that is not being color blind, it's being color conscious. I think
you got a very good point there. Very good point. And even at the same church I've told you about, there are not enough black people and Asian people there now. And so recently they have been called together by we have a lady priest also. And so she has taken it on to talk to the minorities. It's not just restricted to blacks, but to minorities. And I think we started off with the black group to find out how we felt about it. And so there have been two or three meetings, and the whole idea seems to be that we would like to have more. Well, what shall you do to get them? And of course, when I was working in it, what would happen, you see, if you got more black members in, then the white ones would start to leave. And so you end up with an all-black church. So you either had an all-white church or an all-black church. But you've got a good point there.
We actually have in our church what I call a black caucus. There's some of us white people on it. But it is to see that this church acts responsibly in relation to its integration.
Yeah.
And you've got to plan that. That just doesn't happen. I think if you're just colored blind somehow, it doesn't happen in my experience.
You're right. We're going to have to stop because Vespers come soon, and we need to stop early enough so we can get out and get to Vespers. I've enjoyed very much having you join me in this discussion, and I think when we can talk freely about whatever the problem is, we do come up with some answers, and we feel a little better about it. I feel better when I can talk to you, and I have friends, and I have a lot of white friends that I feel very pleased about, that I don't have to think about their being white. They're just like Jackie. She's just Jackie.